What's up, people? Welcome to the podcast. This is episode 14, the first episode of 2023. I'm your host, Micah Walsh, same as always. New year, same me. Today's episode is a conversation that I had with Dan Schlissel, a pretty prolific producer of comedy specials and owner of Stand Up Records. And we chatted it up about death and some of the dead people in his life and some of the dead people we both know. And, it was pretty cathartic. So I hope you guys enjoy listening to it. This is episode 14. I'll grieve you with this, with Dan Schlissel. Well, Dan Schlissel, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me on, Micah.
Of course, man. I appreciate your time. You are the first guest that I've had on who is not a stand-up, but you certainly have...
Oh, no, here go the ratings.
No, you've certainly made a mark on stand-up the last couple of decades with your own label and producing and such. But just for the people who are listening who might be unfamiliar with your background, do you mind giving me and them just sort of a summary of your relationship to comedy? I mean, you own a record label. You've produced a couple hundred albums, yeah?
Yeah, I run Stand Up Records. It's a fairly large independent comedy record label based here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I've been making comedy albums since 2000, so 22 years, going on 23 now. And I've worked with some pretty big names early in their career. I tend to help establish and launch folks on their
record. Doug Stanhope, Maria Bamford, Hannibal Buress.
Yeah, it's I don't
Louis Black.
Yeah, I don't like patting myself on the back.
Well, I can do it for you, but that's so you have a storied history in comedy. What was your first album that you recorded?
The first comedy album was Louis Black's White Album.
Oh, okay, nice, very cool.
So I stepped in at a fairly good level, but also, you know, he hadn't had a comedy album out at that point in time, so you know, I helped establish his recording
career. Yeah, kind of mutually beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. Well, cool. I've recorded maybe 13 of these and I still haven't quite figured out the formula for dipping the toes into the waters of grief, but you mentioned that you have too many dead people in your life, and I'm assuming some of those are our mutual friends. Some of them were recording artists that were on your label.
I have reached the age of 52, which some people think is old, some people think is not old. Either way, you have five decades behind you, so you have a certain accumulated bit of baggage, and some of that is people who have passed away, whether it's through old age or disease or through some kind of misadventure.
Sure.
And, it's just one of those depressing facts in life. So, yes, I've been through it a bunch.
Yeah. Well, my condolences.
Thank you. And mine to you, because I know you wouldn't have started this otherwise.
Sure. Yeah. This is not for any reason other than self-medication. I mean, I like hearing other people's stories, but there's a selfish aspect for me why I do this. I think it helps me, you know, process things that I don't really generally even like thinking about necessarily. But once you get it started, it's like, okay, cool.
I think that's most of us. You know, no one likes to go through this, but it's a fact of life. You know, there's not a living thing that doesn't have a lifespan, and at some point, we all die. Everything dies. The grass dies. I mean, it just eventually the sun will die. You know, it's just the way it is. And, you know, the mourning is good and natural, but I think part of the process is that you have to pick your carcass up and keep on coping and dealing and moving forward. If you're going to, especially if you're in the arts like we are.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you think was maybe your first profound, death that you experienced?
You know, death hits you differently at different points in your life. But the first time I was really kind of aware of the concept was probably when Freddie Prinze committed suicide.
Okay, I'm sure.
He was like the star of Chico and the Man, and I was a little kid, you know?
He was like, I think he was like 19 at that time, too, or something. He was pretty young.
I can't remember the year, but I was like 3, 4, 5, sure, somewhere in there. And it had to be explained. You know, I used to love that TV show, so he had to explain to me
why he's not on anymore.
Yeah, why it's not going on.
Sure.
So, like, that was, you know, and when you're at that kind of young, innocent phase, it's a lot different than hearing stories from your family's past, as good or as bad as those stories might be. We all have some kind of weird story. But, like, that one, I didn't know him, but I knew him from TV. And then probably the second death like that was, you know, and I probably had more in between because I don't know what years these happened. But when Mr. Hooper from Sesame Street passed away, it really kind of.
Okay, sure.
And I might have been considerably older. I didn't look up the years, you know, but it strikes me that it all happened when I was fairly young. And then, you know, just from there on out, it sort of was different stories at different times. It took a while till it hit me personally on a level, probably till John Lennon when I was like 9.
Okay. Yeah.
You know? And, you know, Bob Crane from Hogan's Heroes.
Okay. Like,
those were the
sure. This was your introduction to the concept of mortality.
Well, no, I mean, I grew up the son of a Holocaust survivor, so it wasn't.
Okay.
It
sure.
Was, it was so the first you time it was digestible.
Right.
It wasn't so large that you just couldn't fathom it.
Right. That's almost abstract.
Yeah. I mean,
for a young brain.
Yeah, you just can't. You can't take it in. It took. I mean, I'm still absorbing that one.
Okay.
So.
Tell me about that. So they escaped Europe somehow.
No, they escaped the Germans, and got caught up by the Russians, and their reward for escaping the Germans was being sent to a gulag in Siberia.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay, and that's your parents?
That's my dad. My mom was born in actually British Mandatory Palestine.
Wow.
So before Israel was Israel.
Sure.
She was born to...
Yeah, pre-World War II.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Okay. Fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, different angles on that. And
what was their perspective on death? Were they kind of stoic about it, or did they talk about
stoic. I mean, my dad lost his dad when he was, you know, somewhere between 2 and 7.
Okay.
I don't remember how old he was. I know he was a little kid.
Sure.
And, you know, he had to pretty much have to start earning a living for his family.
Right. Got to grow up quick.
Yeah, real quick. And I mean, my mom grew up in, like I say, she was born in Palestine, and then she was there for the transition to Israel and several of the wars since. And then my dad was in, you know, Israel for some of the wars too.
Okay.
So, you know, when you're 18 to 20 and you serve in the army and you're in wars, some of your friends don't come back, you know?
Yeah. Especially of that era.
Yeah. For better or for worse, that's the nature of war. So,
then typically those people, that they don't talk about it very much either, you know.
My dad would give me the smallest fraction of a story. It wouldn't have a beginning, it wouldn't have an end. It generally be about 2, maybe 3 sentences long, and it would just leave you scratching your head like, what the fuck just happened?
Sure.
And that's all you would get.
Okay.
That was the same, you know, from him surviving the war and his dad's death and being smuggled back through Europe after the war. It was all these little fragments of stories, and you just kind of had to hope other fragments would come so you could piece it together, or try and ask your mom when he wasn't around, my mom when he wasn't right. around. And, you know, it just pretty involved story. So, you know, that's kind of outside of the scope of this. This is
sure. Yeah. Well, whatever. It's certainly relevant. Are your folks still alive?
My mom is. My dad passed away in 94.
Okay. Yeah, do you want to tell me about that?
Yeah, that one was probably the death in my life that has affected me the most.
Sure. Same for me.
My dad and I, by the time I went to college, we did not really get along. I only kind of knew him as a disciplinarian because, you know, I grew up with immigrant parents who had to work their way up from the bottom. So my dad, for a lot of my youth, worked double shifts to ensure that I had a good life. But that means I only saw him a couple hours a day. And it was usually when I was in trouble because I was a kid and lippy,
sure.
And
right.
Whatever else you want to say, a kid does. So I knew him as a disciplinarian, and I just kind of wanted to get the hell away from the town we lived in when I was going to junior high and high school, and I wanted to get my own thing going. So I was really kind of drifting away. But then I started kind of working for him as an intern, not as his choice. His boss hired me to intern.
And what was the line of work?
Textiles.
Okay.
Yeah. My dad was a pretty brilliant textiles guy.
Okay.
And he had worked his way up from basically being a repairman to being a guy who designed factories.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and that was the over the course of, you know, 50 years, 40 years. Actually, no. If he moved, yeah, well, 40 years basically from like the 50s to the 90s.
So if he didn't get you the job, what compelled you to get into textiles at the same place? Just trying, necessity of locality
I was not,
or something?
I was not trying to get into textiles. He never wanted me to go into it. He always kind of threatened me for like, don't do this or I'll, you know.
Sure.
I'll make sure you can't do this.
Okay.
You know, because a lot of times when you know how the sausage is made, you don't want anyone else in your family making the sausage. So, basically, he worked for a company that had several locations throughout the U.S. And we lived in Nebraska, but the headquarters was in New Jersey. He'd answered to a vice president. The vice president knew I was going to school for physics and trying to be an engineer. So he brought me on as an industrial engineering intern. I didn't learn textiles. I was learning about engineering.
Okay.
Statistics and numbers and formulas and efficiencies and all those kinds of things to make a factory run better. That's what I was trying to learn and what I did learn. But since I'd been hired to do that, and my dad didn't say no outright to that. He just said, well, if it'll help you get something better after college, then sure. So the factory wasn't near our house because my mom didn't want to live in the small town that the factory was in. So we lived about 40 miles away, and my dad drove in every day. So when I was working for him, I drove in with him, which meant for 40 minutes a day, driving
twice a day.
Yeah, twice a day. Plus we had lunch together. Plus we had coffee when we got there in the morning together. So through that time period of about 2.5 years of off and on, you know, different holiday breaks from school, working for my dad, we became pretty tight.
Okay.
Really tight, like almost inseparable. And, you know, then I get that for a couple years. And then I was out of college. This was 1993. I had just graduated in the summer. And I was supposed to go home for Thanksgiving. And I start getting phone calls from my mom and my dad saying, hey, don't come home. The house is under quarantine. Dad might have... jaundice, yeah, and it might okay. be and it might be related to I can't remember some what disease,
but they thought it was contagious.
Hepatitis maybe, I can't remember, something contagious. Anyway, don't come home. So I didn't come home, and then it's like, wait, it's not hepatitis, you can come home. Okay, that's the next day. The third day is, you know what, you can't come home. We're coming to Lincoln to go to the hospital to have dad checked out. Okay. So we'll do that. And then we'll either get a hotel in Lincoln and do Thanksgiving together there, or you can come home. Okay. Actually, they are expanding that. And now we have to see an oncologist right after the tests. Okay. Don't come home. All right. Then it was the day before Thanksgiving, basically, and my dad came to Lincoln, went to the hospital, got tested, and was given a death sentence. You have incurable bile duct cancer. You have 6 months to live.
Wow. That's horrible.
Yeah. And that was Thanksgiving.
And he hadn't had any previous health battles before this. That sounds just right out of nowhere.
Look, he was a smoker. He was a smoker, but no, he didn't. You know, he had chronic malnourishment when he was a child. When he came out of Siberia, you know, he had a distended belly, like you see.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And all the things that go along with malnutrition, stunted growth, affecting the teeth, all that stuff, none of which I knew about. You know, all that stuff was kept shielded from me.
You found about that after his death or just later in your life?
I found out about like the teeth probably before his death, but, you know, accident and you keep your mouth shut.
Sure.
And it wasn't through him finding out. It was like one day he was home from work early. And I thought the only reason he used to come home from work early was if I was in trouble for something. I was like, well, what did I do?
Right.
And he didn't want to talk a lot. And he just said, my mouth hurts. I got to see the dentist tomorrow. And it turned out due to malnourishment, when he was a kid, he had to have all of his teeth pulled. And I never knew he had dentures because he never saw them up.
Wow.
And he didn't want anyone to know that he had dentures, not just because of vanity, because he didn't want to have to tell his whole life story to every stranger he ever met. And
sure.
He just didn't want to dwell in that past.
Okay. So from that diagnosis, how long did he live?
5 months.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty devastating. I'm sorry for that, man. That's...
Yeah, the devastating part was I lived 2 hours away from them. So the devastating part was going home every weekend, every other weekend, and, you know, watching him wither away in front of my eyes.
Yeah, and, yeah. You know, what was his attitude towards his death? Did you think that he sort of accepted it, or did he talk about it at all?
We talked about it a little bit. It was not easy to talk about.
Of course.
I was trying to get him to dictate his life story to me, and he just outright said, nope, I've lived through hell once, and I'm not going to do it again now. And
that's fair.
And then, you know, it basically became staring contest, because I'd be like, how are you doing? Well, when I sit, I'm in pain. When I stand, I'm in pain. I can't sleep because I'm in pain. I can't eat. I don't even want to eat. The doctor said, right, I could have as many cigarettes as I want, and I lost the taste for it. And then we would just stare at each other, because every question just became, I'm in pain, I'm dying.
Sure.
And it wasn't pity me. It was like, what else is there to say?
That's fair,
My dad wasn't a guy that would, you know, I love you. He would say it on occasion, but it wasn't like
an overly expressive guy.
I mean, he survived a lot of crap.
Sure. Tell me about what his sense of humor was like, if it existed. Did he find things funny, or
black humor?
Sure. Yeah. And, gallows humor.
Very, very much so. And very dry. He liked a decent one-liner, you know, and being that he was born in the 30s, you know, it wasn't always a fully, it was off color, to put it.
Sure.
So he wouldn't swear a lot, and he wouldn't necessarily make a whole lot of sexual jokes, but like there were plenty of things in the Don Rickles variety that would not.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't, everyone has bias. I don't think my dad was particularly a racist, but he definitely, the humor did go in that territory on occasion. But usually with truism observations, you know, and they were mainly, the really negative ones were mainly pointed at the Russians and Poles and Germans. Like, yeah, those were the really bad ones. Sure. He, you know, if you tried to kill him, he wasn't going to shut his fucking mouth about it.
Okay. He didn't go out quietly.
No, he wouldn't. He wouldn't. I mean, he was a strength kind of guy.
Sure. So what do you think drove you towards comedy coming out of that sort of environment? I mean, maybe that's a weird question.
I think that, you know, you grow up around somebody that wants to laugh because they've been around so much misery. You know, he was always making little jokes of some kind or another.
Sure.
And they weren't all kind of shitty jokes dealing with, you know, differences in people's nationalities and stuff. there was a lot of wry humor. Like one time I was sitting with my mom and dad, and I don't remember what the social setting was, but somebody came up and said to my mom, "So what are your hobbies?" And my mom goes, I like to do China painting. And the lady said, "Well, where do you do that?" And my dad goes, "China."
Nice. Yeah, that's pretty dry.
Yeah.
That's good.
One of his favorite lines was, you know, "When in Rome, do like the Romanians."
Nice. Yeah.
You know, it was things like sure. that aren't necessarily classic slap your knee, and they aren't just dad jokes.
Yeah, they're more like absurdisms.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, he was really into the Marx Brothers. He grew up in Siberia. They saw Charlie Chaplin movies.
So yeah.
You know, because Charlie was considered a communist here by a lot of right wingers. So there was a lot of that. He loved the Marxists. He, you know, we even liked Benny Hill.
Okay. You
know? So it was a wide ranging thing. And I basically got my love of comedy from that. And my mom had these records of an Israeli sketch comedy group in Hebrew that she would play when I was a kid. And those were pretty, I speak Hebrew, so, and I understand it. But so to me, that was pretty, a pretty big revelation as well. You know, sure. And me being a first generation American, there's all the stuff on TV. SNL started when I was in my single digits, and I got to see a lot of episodes of it.
Right.
You know, Johnny Carson. And
a big cultural moment for comedy.
Yeah, yeah, I lived through the comedy boom, you know, and sure. I was, you know, very impressed by it.
Sure.
So that's kind of my entry point into comedy is that sketch comedy group and the stuff that was filtered through my dad and all the TV marathons that would run and stuff like that.
Okay. Do you recall the first time that you laughed after your dad died? Or was there any moment of levity before or after during that week?
No, that week there was not. You know, my dad died, and in Jewish tradition, you do the funeral right away.
Right. So,
like, he died on the 4th, he was buried on the 5th, and by the time I got to my mom's house and did a bit of mourning, I didn't do the traditional sit on the ground for 7 days and stay at home. I went to see my best friend and you know, drink a lot.
Sure.
And when I got to his house, he just said, he was sitting on the sofa and he was just sitting there with a cigarette, and he goes, "Well, they found Kurt Cobain's body today." And I just went right back out to my car and just cried.
So that was the same day, huh? Or the same week?
The next
yeah.
day.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's kind of a 1-2 hit of like such a huge national figure that you don't know but probably identify with, and then also the fuck your father back to back.
Yeah, I mean, I started my record label in 1992, my music label, and that'll tell you how closely it was tied to Nirvana.
Sure. Okay.
So, yeah, it felt like in 24 hours that pretty much everything had been taken away.
Yeah, I would imagine pretty disorienting.
Yeah. Yeah, so there wasn't a whole lot of laughing that week. I mean, I don't even like to think about that week now. And it's, you know, almost 30 years later. You know, I still had the dirt on my hands from helping fill the grave, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty immediate. The one-day turnaround on that.
Yeah, and, you know, my family's a bit traditional. I wouldn't say I'm religious necessarily because I'm not. But we're pretty traditional for customs and stuff.
Sure. So,
you know, at a Jewish funeral, when you were at the graveside, everybody's supposed to take a shovel of dirt and throw it in. But when you're in the middle of Nebraska and you're surrounded by non-Jews who don't know that tradition, then you, your brother, and your cousin wind up filling in a grave in front of an audience.
Oh, you have to do the whole thing then in that case. It's not just symbolic and then...
Well, they offered the cemetery, the Jewish cemetery said, you know, this isn't ancient times. We have bulldozers. And my brother and cousin and I at the same time, without even looking at each other, said no machines.
That's what he would have wanted.
Mm-hmm. My dad, when his dad died, it was in Siberia, and it was like wintertime, and they had to bury him shallowly. And my dad said to me, you know, my dad didn't have an accent, but he spoke with the cadence of somebody not born here. And he said, we buried him, and I put pointed sticks in the ice because we couldn't bury him very deep. And I said, well, why the pointed sticks? And he said, to keep away the wolf.
Yeah, that's a little bit different than contemporary American death traditions.
No. And I think that, you know, that's a lot of what sets me apart better or worse than a lot of people here who've grown up here for generations and don't have those stories, you know, at their fingertips.
So would you call that like inherited trauma or just sort of like the context of your environment or maybe there's overlap between those two?
Oh, I mean, there's total overlap and I would just say yes to that.
Sure. Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. I have that, you know, I have that right at my fingertips. I have an uncle that had numbers on his arm, you know?
Yeah.
And woke up, you know, 50 years later in the middle of the night screaming still.
Yeah.
So, that'll you know, you. I have a different take on this reality than a lot of people. So, you know, you can deny all the Holocaust numbers that you want if you're into that. But that's my family went up a chimney, a lot of them.
Yeah, that's pretty.
And I'm not gonna forget that. And if you're the kind of person, not you, but if you're the kind of person that says that kind of thing to me, you're done. You're out.
Yeah, I mean, that's something nobody should ever forget.
And that's kind of that kind of stuff is what was driven into me by my dad, was not, you know, do not forget from a very
I mean, keeping the memory alive of the ancestors is a big part of a lot of things, but I mean especially if that is so recent in your own history.
Yeah, but you gotta remember, like, you know, trying to keep alive the ancestors when a lot of those records disappear in the 30s.
Sure. It's hard to keep
alive, you know, and it gets way worse than that the further back you dig, you know.
Did your folks come through Ellis Island by any chance?
No, my dad emigrated in 1967. He came through,
so it was close to the airport. Oh, okay, sure.
And then I think my mom and brother came in 68.
And you were born shortly thereafter then. So they had just moved here.
Yeah, I was 3 years after my dad moved here, 2 years after my mom moved here.
Nice. Yeah, interesting. Well, so you don't recall any time when the sort of the sunlight coming back after that period, there's no point where like...
I mean, it came back, you know, that's the thing about this stuff is it cycles.
Sure.
But, you know, I started seeing the woman that became my fiance and then my wife a year and a month and a day after my dad passed. And I just remember it because the dates lined up that way. And not, you know, like my dad died on 4/4/94 and I started dating my wife on 5/5/95. So it was real easy to remember.
Those right. Days.
It's not like, you know, we humans look for patterns and that's a pretty distinct pattern.
Right.
So it was easy to remember that. And I think she brought Sun back into my life, but it had to have been coming back somewhat for her to even want to go out with me.
Sure.
But it was a pretty, pretty indelible ditch that it left in me.
Yeah. Yeah. I would imagine so. Certainly the most profound thing that happened to me is my own dad dying, but, yeah. What's, let's talk about other people that, who else would you say is a significant loss in your life in the timeline of tragedy?
I don't know. I don't have dates memorized for everybody that I know that passed, but definitely, you know, losing Mitch Hedberg a couple years after I got to record his second album was a bummer. I only got to know him when we were recording, and then I stayed friendly with him for the short time I had.
Sure.
Between there passing, but not friendly enough so that I knew any of his issues in his life or anything like that. It caught me by surprise as much as it did anyone else.
Yeah.
And I heard about that backstage at a Ron White show. And then I called Doug Stanhope, who confirmed it. And then I watched the news break throughout the world on that one.
Yeah, that's crazy. And I feel like, if I remember right, some people thought it was like an April Fool's because it happened on like the first or something.
That sounds right. I don't remember the date. I do remember it had to have been spring though.
He was so cold. He was so funny.
He was funny, and he was really nice. Like,
that's good to hear.
He was a quiet dude, but he was just really, really nice.
Sure.
So that's kind of what makes that one, you know, it's sad to lose a talent, but to lose a good dude on top of it's just such a ridiculous, you know.
Yeah. And he had such a unique voice. Like,
yeah.
And to hear that he's a good guy, it's like, I suspected it as much, but, you know, as well as I do, you hear about other people in the industry, we're like, oh, that guy sucks.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and if you're in this industry long enough, you become the guy who sucks no matter what you do. So, you know, at least Mitch didn't get that kind of crap thrown on him.
Sure.
Then Mike DiStefano I was very close with him, and he died about a month after we recorded his second album.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So that one was a pretty big one.
Sure.
And it sucked.
Did you produce it posthumously?
The second album, yeah, after a long struggle of dealing with lawyers and estates. And
I would imagine just you would want his work to be out there, but I imagine just like everything else in death.
I would have liked it to have been out, but it is out there.
Right.
I had proposed something different than what the final second release was, and I still think that should come out, but I've been outvoted.
By the estate?
Basically. It's a bummer. He had certain views on things that his family didn't have.
And they didn't want that to be...
Even though I was requested to, by him, do things his way, not knowing he was going to die, but I knew very much what he wanted.
Remind me how he died. Did he...
Heart attack. Sudden heart attack.
Wow. Yeah. So no heads up at all.
Nope. He was a long time recovering addict. You know, he had done a lot of work to help a lot of people in his life, and he was still doing it. And he was this dude that, like, if you knew him a little bit and got past that New York tough guy thing, he was like the biggest heart, the most radiating light. And, you know, to have that snuffed out is just such a kick in the junk, basically.
Yeah. It's like the floor falling out.
It is. And it, you know, I still distribute those records that I released, you know, and every time I have to do royalties, you know, and send out that payment, I just think, I just wish you were here instead, dude.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And,
you know, that one was a pretty big one because he was such a good dude and just such a positive force. And even though he had been through such horrible things by choice and through circumstance, he just related to people like your pain is my pain kind of thing without saying it. I remember he came to Grumpy's once, didn't go on stage, just hung out and watched that, you know, pitiful little alley room.
Sure. And I love Grumpy's.
I do too. I rest in peace. I know that one affected me too, but that's not a person. You know, he watched every single person and he talked to every single person about like, hey, you could do this, you could do that. And it was all like, I listened to all of that advice and all of it was not overbearing, not like you don't know what you're doing, just so spot on, so helpful, such pure love. And then when he and I walked out of there, he and I walked out and he was on my left side and I looked at him and he had this radiant smile. He goes, man, that room makes you work, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, that room really does, man.
And I just thought, you just sat through 3.5 hours, 4 hours of this.
Right.
And you have that. How beautiful of a human being are you? You're not upset that I dragged you to this thing. God dang.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then just gone. Mike's gone.
Yeah.
And that's the way the news is. You know, it doesn't matter how well they break it. It's just like, you know, they tell you the person's gone and then there's just that bomb blast ringing in your ears as you try and like breathe and have tunnel vision come back to real.
Sure. Sure.
And it's always that. It's always that. It's never not that. It's never not a, eh, oh well.
No, it's like you've been fucking drugged or something and it all kicks in. You're like what? That couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. That just the pit in your stomach.
I've only had a couple of times where I've heard it, usually about someone I really didn't like, where I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. Surprised it took this long.
Sure. Well, if you want to discuss those people specifically, we could, but that's not necessarily the nature of this. Although, listen, I'm going to, when Henry Kissinger, when he dies, I'm going to be dancing. When there's certain people.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I tend to have a lot of big heart towards people. And I'm not going to get into the case of Kissinger here because that's not my field.
So. Okay, sure. But I'm just saying, like, when I see that George W. Bush lived to be like 98, I'm always like, you know, where's the justice? But
yeah, the CIA guy gets to live. But it's not up to me. If it was, you know, we probably would have never gone through the previous presidency, you know. If, right. If I could manipulate God's will to do the things that were correct, he would have burnt to a crisp like one of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, not touch the Western Wall.
Sure.
That was actually proof to me that there probably isn't a God.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good evidence. That was proof to me that I was like, I thought like, oh, the Illuminati doesn't. They don't control. This guy wasn't supposed to become president. Everyone invested in this did not want him to become president. And they're like, oh, I guess we'll just acclimate. I guess we're
I will give you one other example that directly relates to our former president. To me, he's proof that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
You think so?
Yeah. Yeah. Definite proof of it because, everybody was so comfortable with him as a character that nobody tried. I don't think the only conspiracy I believe in with him is the conspiracy to keep him president on January 6th.
You know, sure. Yes.
That's the only, but to me, it proves that like a conspiracy of people couldn't have done anything because they didn't for him. Lee Harvey Oswald bought a gun, took the action in his hands and did it. And I'm not saying he was right. He definitely wasn't. Kennedy should have lived a long.
Yeah, I'm going to go on the record agreeing with you on there. Also, Lee Harvey Oswald was not right to do that.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that anybody who chooses that path is the right thing because it's not. However, to me, that's proof that Lee Harvey Oswald did act alone.
Hmm.
So,
I could go on at length about my opinions about that, but that was probably won't.
Yeah, but that's outside of the scope of this.
Right.
We're just trying to talk.
Although, you know what? While we're getting on a tangent, an anecdote I learned only in the last couple of years about my father is, well, he lived in Texas when he was a teenager. His parents sent him to seminary school. Oh, and wow. He actually saw JFK the day before he was in Dallas. He did the same parade in San Antonio.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah. So, my dad, you know, got out of school and went and saw the president. And then the next day, same motorcade. That's interesting.
You know, I went to the book depository. The first time I went to Texas was to record Maria Bamford. The first time I went as an adult.
Oh, that's where she recorded?
Yeah. It might not be as an adult. The first time I made a road trip down to Texas was to record Maria Bamford.
Okay.
I might have gone to South by Southwest before that once. I don't remember the year right now. Timelines aren't so great for me since my whole longer thing that I don't want to get into yet. But when we drove going north up Interstate 35 to come back to Minnesota, you drive through downtown Dallas. And as my recording engineer buddy and I were driving up, I look to the right and I go, that's where Kennedy was shot. He goes, how do you know? I go, I've seen enough films that I can see it from. He goes, from the highway on a different angle. I go, that's definitely it. He goes, what do you want to do? I said, go to the next exit. Let's turn around. I want to go. Sure. I want to go see it. So we did that. And I don't remember if we toured the depository that day or not, but we definitely went and parked and, you know, stood on the X.
They have the X.
Yeah.
I was just talking with someone about that because it came up in conversation because, they were observing, a friend of mine was like, why isn't there any thing for John Lennon outside of the Dakota? Is that why it is?
Yeah.
I also thought like it's a site where someone was murdered. Maybe they don't, you know, it's not the most, there is a part of Central Park that's called Strawberry Fields. It's right across from there. So there's that, but
I mean, Yoko has to come and go. still, and she has to walk by that spot every day.
I suppose she doesn't want
to see it marked out, and she doesn't want to be approached by stalkers at that point in that physical location. And so, like, for that reason,
Well, in that case, and that makes sense. That makes it weirder to me that there's an X in the middle of the road. That seems just a little like unemotional to just be like, oh, here's where it happened.
Well, if you think that's unemotional, you probably shouldn't come back to Minneapolis, and you should avoid George Floyd Square.
Okay, well, yeah, that's a really good counterpoint.
So to me, and, you know, look, I don't like to glorify tragedy, but when I was a kid, we went to Israel when I was like 5 years old. And in Israel in 1976, there had already been built in standing was a memorial to John F. Kennedy. And the memorial, when you see it, a photo from outside, like not at ground level, you see that it looks like a tree trunk that has been cut off at the base. And the roots that extend from it are 50 cement structures.
Okay.
So, you know, this is in another country.
Right. So, I didn't realize that he had such a, oh, I guess, I don't really know JFK and his relationship with Israel.
That's outside of the scope of this. We can get into
sure,
it.
What yeah.
I'm trying to say here is, you know, obviously in Ireland, there's a connection because of Kennedy being an Irishman by descent, but like to have a memorial to him in Israel. Jacqueline Kennedy, when she was trying to sort out what was going to be done for a memorial at the grave site at Arlington, had visited sites around the world, and she went to Israel's Holocaust Museum, saw that there were eternal flames there for every one of the camps, and she borrowed the idea of the eternal flame for John F. Kennedy's grave.
Sure.
So there are some ties there. I couldn't explain them to you now. That's not in my head because I haven't read up on it. But I saw that memorial when I was a kid. I was there in person. Mm. You know, and I thought, it's so crazy that this other country has a thing for an American president here. But that's how big of an effect it had around the world. And people are morbid. They want to go to the site to have their moment with the memory of the person.
Yeah, very much so. That's funny you mentioned that, because I experienced a similar thing when I was in Italy last year in Milan. I walked past their 9/11 memorial. And I was like, whoa, this is so far away from what, like where this happened. And it's weird to have like an avatar that's not even there. It's good to keep the memory alive, I suppose, you know, but it is interesting like that.
Yeah. And I'm always about, you know, I didn't make the walk out, the half mile or quarter mile walk, because my back's a little messed up compared to when I was a kid. But I went to the first spot of the Buddy Holly plane crash where it's marked road, and then you walk in. I've been to the Surf Ballroom. I called my best friend, who's a big Buddy Holly fan, from the same phone booth that Buddy called his wife from.
Okay, sure.
Not because somebody said, hey, you should blah, 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 blah. I just thought, well, my best friend loves Buddy Holly. And it probably.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, these people are so important to us that we just even being in the same location as something that happened to them is like sort of something we can hold on to.
Right. And also, I wanted to stand on that X and look at that window, because you read so the much.
Angles. Yeah. It. Whether yeah. or not. Yeah.
And, you know, when you go into the building, which I think I did at a later date, I don't think I did it that trip. When you go up to the building, you can't get up to that window because they have it kind of recreated as the scene, but glassed off. But you can kind of flip around a little bit. You can walk around the glass enough to try and get a view out to the X. And it's not as difficult as they make it out to be in all those documentaries. It's the hard part would be shooting that many shots in that short of a time. And if you're a Marine sniper, it's not that hard. I mean, I went and I looked, and it's like, if I think I could do it, then certainly a Marine sniper could do it.
Sure.
Not that I would want to, but I'm just saying, you see yourself in that spot, you're going to morbidly look.
It is interesting, just the concept of sort of death tourism. I work in a sort of a tourist, I interact with a lot of tourists in New York City. And the other day, this woman, I was like, so what's your plan? She's like, well, tomorrow we're doing Central Park. Then we're going to go do the 9/11 thing. And I was just like, did you just do the 9/11 thing?
That irritates me for a number of reasons, not because the memorial exists, but like the whole commodification of it and packaging it as a number. Like, you know, when FDR was on in Congress, he didn't say 12/7/41, a day that will live in infamy. The day was such an indelible black mark on history. He named it in full. Sure. So I never, ever abbreviate it. It's always September 11th. It's all because the people who died that day, they deserve that respect. It's an insult to their memory to commodify it and go along with the masses. It diminishes their loss and the terror that they had to live in those last minutes of their lives.
Oh, yeah. I am the type of person who, you know, I've laughed at 9/11 jokes. I know that 9/11 is objectively probably the worst thing that will happen to humans in my, well, maybe that's sorry.
Oh, it is.
I know there's slavery that exists, but as far as a cultural moment of collective loss, it's so big that it's really incomprehensible. It's like abstract.
It is, but it's on a minor level. You know, I lost, 200 times that many co-religionists and, you know,
sure.
Family members, 200, 2000. I don't even know the exact magnitude.
Well, that's also very incomprehensible to me.
You know, I went and visited the memorial for the Arizona in Pearl Harbor. There was one of the had to do things. I had to go there and I had to, you know, say my prayers for those sailors and Marines that lost their lives because, you know, their sacrifice ultimately led to the stopping of the industrialized murder of my people.
Yeah.
So I had to go and say thanks.
Yeah, pay your respects.
Yeah. That's and fair. I had to go and touch the USS Missouri. I had to touch it every single place that I could touch it because that's where the surrender was signed.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine that's a pretty solemn place to be.
The Arizona more so. It's a tomb for sure, and you're given a set of rules on the little cruise over to it, and it's a very moving experience. So, like for those things, I have to stop and pay the respects. And sorry, I didn't mean to get weepy and weird, but
no, you're good. You're good. I mean,
you know, those lives affect me more than some of the people that I've known that have slipped away. You know,
sure.
Is that really?
It really, changed history.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing for me on those. But, you know, let's get back to my personal stuff rather than these abstract large numbers. And
sure.
And I'm sorry I took it that way.
That's all good.
You know, I September 11th is tough for me because of my personal experience that day. But then somehow somebody with my last name died that day in one of the towers, and I wasn't related by any stretch of the imagination, but I certainly felt compelled to go to the open pit memorial. I didn't go inside. I'm not ready for that right now. I don't know if I could deal with that at the moment, but I had to go there and I had to find his name, and I had to make sure to, with a piece of cloth, make sure the name was wiped clean. And
yeah. I went there not long ago and I saw someone left flowers and some candy, like a Reese's. And I don't know why the candy kind of fucked me up because I was like, yeah. Right. More so than the flowers.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, I went there with my mom and my family and had to do it. We all had to see the name. And I just wanted to make sure that somebody had taken care of it. Even look, there aren't that many Schlissels. I didn't know the guy, probably not related, but with the same name, probably are related somehow. So I just had to do that for myself.
Yeah.
And I've had other situations like that that I'm not going to get into here where it's like, oh, I'm someplace on Memorial Day. I should go keep an eye on the tomb or whatever.
Sure.
I'll tell you about that stuff off air. I don't want to talk about it here.
Yeah, fair.
But, yeah, so like that abstract version of death hits you too, but you know, if that kind of stuff hits me the way it does, then you can imagine what it is when it's a personal loss. It's obviously much more significant and meditative thing. You know, I'll try and pull it back towards people we both No.
Well, certainly Gus Lynch was a profound loss, I'm sure, for you and for the Minneapolis comedy scene in general.
He was a controversial character for one reason or another, but he was really the glue of the scene here, as far as I could see.
Sure. And I've mentioned it before on the podcast, but he was the first person in Minneapolis who was clearly a very funny person who would give me compliments without any provocation. He would, you know, be like, "Hey, I liked that one joke, da 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 da," and that was very validating for me personally.
Right.
Because he was a tremendous performer. I mean, he was very funny.
That kind of thing would have to come from him, because he was your peer, you know? Yeah, sure, he was a couple of years ahead of you, but he was your peer. He was up there delivering and writing and performing. Oh, yeah. I couldn't give you that kind of compliment, because I'm not a performer. And if I did, it wouldn't have had the same.
It was just the first person who acknowledged it and told me, like, "Hey, you're doing good." I was like, "Fucking right. That's the people I need validation for, the people that I think are funny."
Right.
So that was a real moment for me where I was like, "Cool, this guy's all right." Even though, yes, he did have some qualities that were perhaps not the greatest, but we don't need Look, to.
Everybody's got that.
Very much so.
You know, it's just that some people you know about it, some people you find out later. You know, but for me, he was somebody who was, you know, close to my age, close enough to my age, and he was new and working it and looking for advice career wise and organization wise, you know, as far as material. And, you know, he was engaging me as a producer, and I got along with him well. We both had families, we both had, right, you know, things that we weren't just young kids trying to figure it out, even though, you know, this is, you know, 10 years ago, roughly. I first met him in 2010, I believe, 2009, somewhere in there. But like, we very quickly bonded as friends and as peers on that level. And he was just an incredibly epic and fun person to hang out with.
Yeah. Real big energy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just somebody who made you feel like you were a better person for hanging out with them. And that is such a rare quality that it can't be undervalued at all. So he made me more me, is how it felt.
That's a pretty huge compliment.
Yeah. And that's why I kind of always sought to be around him.
Yeah.
So, you know, our friendship was so tight that it, at a certain point, it became natural for him to take on a lot of the live aspects of my label that aren't necessarily making a recording. So if I wanted to, "Hey, let's organize a showcase," he was on top of it. And we worked so well together that it traveled, and we started doing it all over the place. We did, most famously, we did shows in Acamal, Mexico, and Tulum, and Playa del Carmen, and Puerto Aventuras, all along the Mexican Riviera, because he came from a family that had property down there. So because that property was available to him, then all of a sudden this became something we could do. I made the pitch to him on a vacation, drunk in a pool.
Sure. Yeah, I remember in Minneapolis as a new comic just being like, "Damn, these people are doing, they get to do a comedy festival in Mexico." I was seeing the pictures and videos and stuff with envy. But yeah, it looked like a pretty good scene.
It was all meant to be a mirage. And, you know, that's essentially what it was. But
how many years did you produce that?
4.
Okay. Yeah.
And then a bunch of ancillary off-season shows. When I say off-season, we would do the festival in the spring, and then we would do like Day of the Dead shows as well.
Sure. Nice.
And, you know, Gus was just very much a team player in that regard. We would do unofficial showcases during South by Southwest, not part of, but during. And he was part of that. We did shows in New Orleans. We did shows in New York City. We were trying to put together a tour, and, you know, Gus was really good at keeping that, the wheels on the ground on that stuff and getting it to move forward, and also not losing the sight of, hey, this is supposed to be fun.
Hmm.
Now, it turns out that the fun sort of overtook the project at some point, you know, but he died through mayhem not related to comedy.
Yeah, in Mexico.
In Mexico, yeah, he fell off a pyramid, which can happen, but it's unusual. It's not so unusual that it happens twice a year, generally, at least.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable way to go out, especially for such a high energy guy. I remember, you know, word travels pretty fast in the comedy scene, in Minneapolis comedy scene in particular. But yeah, that was pretty devastating. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, yeah. And
so how did you get the call? Who'd you, if you don't mind me, do you remember who informed you of this?
I want to say maybe Gabe Noah.
Okay.
That seems like where it came from. It was probably either him or Chris Maddock.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
One of the two. But I knew about it from the minute he fell. Well, I knew about it before he had passed.
Right. I feel like there was some time in between the fall and he died in a hospital.
Yeah, it was like 6 hours.
Yeah. Wow.
It wasn't really that much. Well, it might have been 12 hours. But
yeah, insane.
It was less than 24 is what I'm trying to get at.
Here. Sure.
You know, that really just broke me, because I had to make a lot of the phone calls to our partners in Mexico.
Sure. And
all over the place. And my partners in Mexico, as a married couple, they were driving and they literally had to stop and pull their car over while they were driving with their kids.
Yeah, I would imagine.
They knew him real well, and even they were down there and didn't know he had passed. They knew he had fallen.
Sure.
And word might have come from them, actually. Huh. I don't remember that. I don't really dig at that scab very much.
Sure. For good reason, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's still leaving my head wrong all these years later, 8 years later.
Yeah, so I think you posted something about how it's been 8 years. Does it feel like it's been longer or shorter than that? Because for me, time really doesn't exist in relationship to reality in regards to grief.
It's both. And before I get into that, let me just say that, you know, it took a little while to get Gus's body back to the United States.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that.
It took a little bit. And so there was I had to go out of town to record, but his body came back in time to have a memorial service. So we had a memorial service, and then the next morning I was supposed to fly out to record, which I did. And then when I flew back a couple days later, they were going to have a wake that I helped put on at the turf club. And they did that so that I could have my travel and not have to cancel my recording trip, in part why they did that. One of the courtesies the family extended to our relationship, you know. And the memorial service, the memorial service was pretty rough. I couldn't go in the room where his body was.
Hmm.
Yeah. I couldn't. I didn't. I'm not an open casket guy because, you know, my tradition is different, and I don't care what the greater tradition is for the bigger part of society. I don't want to look at a corpse.
They look like mannequins. They don't look like your friend. They look like,
be that as it may, I don't want to see it.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying this is a reason to not want to.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand that as well.
So I just couldn't go in the room. I was out in the hallway listening to everything. And when they wheeled him by me afterwards, I averted my eyes and just, like, it was PTSD for real. But this is all going to tell you that as hard as all that was, one of our friends was not there that night and nobody could figure out why. And the next day I'm at MSP getting ready to fly to Detroit and I get a call from Josh Cavanis. This I remember. And Josh said, "Are you sitting down?" I said, "I just had breakfast, so I'm sitting." And he just kept on asking me if I was sitting down to the point that I finally said, "I'm sitting. Just tell me." He goes, "We found Bill Young's body just now."
Yeah.
And I haven't talked about Bill here yet, but Bill was another one of those dudes who was kind of like the glue of the scene. He was Bill the was guy.
He was a really great guy. Yeah. He was.
He was another one of those super encouraging dudes that was all about comedy. He probably wasn't going to ever make a huge name, but he was super funny. A lot of people would tell you they're the funniest person he knew. He's the funniest person they knew. Sorry, I worded that wrong. And
yeah, I remember that. Bill was a very funny guy.
And, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't seem to be too career oriented, and it didn't really seem like that mattered to him. He was very funny. He would murder. Yeah, I think I've hosted for him a couple times at the Comedy Corner Underground. But yeah, very, very funny guy and a nice dude in my experience.
And the sweet, like, he's literally somebody that would give you the shirt off his back.
Yeah,
he was literally that guy. And we were close because we had worked on a bunch of stuff together, including Drinking with Ian, which was a cable access TV show here. And he was on the first festival in Mexico. And I can't remember. I think I might have helped subsidize his ticket, actually, because I just loved him so much and I wanted him to be there. And he was on our 499 shows, and he was just, there's other, we used to do shows at this comic book convention called Convergence, which to call it a comic con is not fair. It's really a weekend nerd party, but we would put on like a comedy club at the hotel. And he was always like one of the key, him and Gus and I.
Sure.
That was how we did it, you know, and his ex-wife, Jenna, Bill's ex-wife, Jenna, they were the key players in organizing that. And in, you know, 2 days, I lost everybody I relied on almost.
Yeah.
So to me, that was kind of the beginning of the end of the Minneapolis scene.
I would absolutely agree from my own personal experience. That was such a 1-2 thing. It was like, I can't believe it again. Like, I don't believe this.
Yeah,
it was sort of like the end of the party. Lights are coming on, like, you know, reality setting in.
Yeah. And, you know, I got that news on the way to a recording gig, and I had a recording engineer with me, and a different comedian on the label was passing through town, and they stayed for the whole weekend in order to help me get through the recording process, which I kind of, you know, luckily I, as a producer, all I got to do is encourage the artist to be in their proper headspace. I'm not actually running cable or hitting buttons.
Sure.
So capable people with me for that, and another person to help distract me and get me through the grief, because it was just such a bell ring of grief. I wasn't even drinking. I just.
Yeah.
You know, was just trying to put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah. The show must go on.
Yeah. And luckily, you know, thanks to those two folks, we pulled it together. The album came out great, but then I flew home, hopped in my car that had been in short-term parking, and went to Gus's wake.
Bill's wake.
No, Gus's.
Oh, wake. Yeah, Gus. Okay. And then that was the night before Bill's body was discovered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the memorial was the night before. The wake was 2 days later when I came back from recording.
That's okay. Yeah, what an insane period of time for you.
Yeah, it wasn't good. What do you do when the representation of fun in your life dies? You know, and then a year later, I went through my own medical escapade that people can listen to my episode of WTF to hear that. And
well, you want to give me the cliff notes? I know you've had some sort of brushes with.
I had to have neck surgery because I lost a genetic lottery. And then in recovery, I died.
Yeah, I think I seem to recall something about your heart stopping reading that.
Well, first off, I choked to death, and that's what stopped my heart. My heart didn't just stop. I was deprived of oxygen.
Wow.
Yeah, so I choked on a neck brace, heart stopped, dead 1 to 3 minutes, which on the relative scale of things doesn't seem that long, but you try it.
Are you kidding me? That seems very long. I would think that even a second or two is probably in a territory that most people don't come back from.
Yep.
So
I went through all that and all the experiences and the nurse telling me I was a medical miracle at the end of my month at the hospitals. And
did that give you, lend you new perspective on, what do you want to do with your time, or writing like a will or something?
I wrote the will before I went into the hospital.
Sure.
Because I didn't know, because it was neck surgery performed by a neurosurgeon.
Oh, so, okay. They're just moonlighting on the... No. As also doing the neck? Or
no, that's part of... Because it was affecting my spinal column.
Okay.
And my central nervous system. That's when you call in a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, that's... not a good place to be. What was that, like Mayo Clinic or something?
Nope. St. Joe's in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is no longer a hospital.
All right.
Not through my doing, but it's no longer a hospital.
I'm glad you didn't have any hand in their demise.
I wish I would have.
Oh, it was that.
I also have some good memories from there, but ultimately they did allow me to die. So,
yeah, that's going on the Yelp review.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole lot on the Yelp review. Also, while I was in the hospital recovering from that, Andy Ritchie, who was on my label, died of a brain tumor.
Jeez.
So here I am in a hospital surviving when, three of my friends are dead. And, not including Kate Urquhart, who was also a loss earlier than Gus and Bill.
Yeah, I remember Kate. She was a fixture in the Minneapolis scene.
Also one of those great people. Yeah. Love her or hate her, she was awesome.
I don't think I met anyone who hated her.
Yeah, I mean, there were some people who didn't like her strong vocal, opinion on stuff, but I always appreciated it because it was always good to have another set of eyes on something. Sometimes it was realistic to have a viewpoint that you didn't have as your own. So while I was recovering from my whole hospital thing, I was having a real hard time of it. It was... Spent a lot of time staring into the abyss, as Nietzsche would tell you, and that abyss, it does stare back, and it's fucking unforgiving and relentless. And, I made it through my time with that, but part of my recovery was my wounds got infected, and I had to deal with daily antibiotics dosages, and those are given at a cancer clinic, and
yeah.
My time at the cancer clinic for that following month was very, very stressful and tough. And I met this dude there, Dave. I'd have to look up his last name now because memory isn't what it was. But Dave was just this positive dude that had been through so much, and he was still somehow super religiously faithful. He had a spiritualist faith. Now, I don't have that piece. I certainly don't have it from a non-Jewish viewpoint. And I wasn't attracted to that part necessarily, but what was attractive to me was that he still had this inner beauty and light and positivity.
Sure. He's not going to let this define him.
Nope. And he's going to keep plowing and positive attitude. And I really needed that. I needed to have somebody be able to model that for me that was external.
Sure.
The whole situation.
And hospitals are a drag. It's easy to get hopeless when you're.
Yeah. And also that hopelessness will drag down everyone near you.
Oh, yeah.
So to have that, like when you mountain climb, you hammer something into the rock that you can clip onto.
Yeah.
That is basically what Dave was doing for me, was he was serving as that clip.
Sure.
And we stayed in communication briefly after that. And I say briefly because he eventually succumbed to his illnesses.
Sorry to hear that.
And, yeah, you know, again, like earlier with my dad and celebrities, you know, what do you do when the person that models fun in your life and the other person that models faith in your life?
Yeah. You kind of have to pick up the pieces and sort of
see
where you can fit them together. But it's certainly, you know, you said something about the sun rising like every day. That's kind of how I felt. Like for me, some of these losses in my life, it's kind of like if you woke up and the sun didn't rise.
Yeah.
But only for you. So everyone else is just still going on because the sun's still up for them. But for whatever reason, it's just truly like I don't know. It's a loss of reality. Like I truly, some of these deaths, I think I process maybe 2 or 3 years later. Cause for the first couple of years, I'm just like, it's like getting slapped in the face. You don't think, yeah, wow, that hurts. You go, well,
it's literally like,
yeah,
you know, it's literally that.
And you don't, yeah. When you get physically hurt, you don't process like, oh, wow, this fire touched my skin and now it's hurting because no, you just go, wow, that really hurts. But you don't really, in the same way, you know, grief takes a little while to unpack.
Yeah. You know, and you had it more directly. I was friendly with, but not necessarily like in the same social circles with Raghav, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So we always had good conversations. They were always serious minded, but I wouldn't necessarily say we were close. Liked him. I thought he was a good dude.
And I liked Raghav as well. We weren't the best of friends, but we were certainly contemporaries, and right, we briefly lived together for maybe 2 months.
But I didn't realize it was that short.
He was a nice guy, and you know, unfortunate. You know, it was an accident, and you know, what are you gonna do? Sometimes people miscalculate. I don't know the details of it, but I believe it was a mistake.
I don't want to get into the details, but accidents have taken out, you know, took out Gus, took out Bill, you know, the long-term diseases took out Kate, and you know, sudden occurrences and things like Mike DiStefano, and
yeah,
you know, Sean Rouse, another person that we lost that I miss a lot.
Chad Martin passed during the pandemic, and that
Chad was always,
he was one of those people that just could make everyone feel like in a better mood,
a beautiful soul. And it's always a shame to lose those beautiful souls, because this world is just a slog, and there's no, I mean, I'm very much of the Bob Marley philosophy of, you know, if you know what life is worth, you'll look for yours on earth, you know?
Sure.
I don't believe there's an after. There might be, maybe I'll be surprised, you know, but I don't believe there's an after. I believe you're here for your time, and you got to make something of it, because that's what, sure, you get.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what makes it so much more devastating, when you're like, man, this is a character in my life that just doesn't, their story ended. My book's still going, and that's just kind of like, that's just a new scar that I have, you know?
Agreed and not agreed, because Gus and Bill are very much alive while I am alive. Mike DiStefano.
Sure, absolutely. And yeah, so, I would say the same thing about musicians. I could watch Norm Macdonald until I'm dead, and he will be making me laugh harder than people that are currently alive.
Yeah, but that's not quite what I'm getting at. Like,
okay,
after my hospitalization, especially as it was all kind of, as I was finding out I was sick, I was in New Orleans putting on a memorial show for Gus at the same festival he had run the year before for me, right before he died, within like a week, 2 weeks of his death.
Hmm.
He had run a stand-up records showcase at Hell Yes Fest in New Orleans. And a year later, they moved the festival up to October. I booked a memorial show for Gus. And stand-up records showcase, but the reason was it was a memorial. And to that point, I hired a New Orleans jazz band to lead a funeral procession.
Nice.
I had Mardi Gras style doubloons made with Gus's face on them that we threw out in the procession.
That's fantastic.
And
he would have loved that.
He deserved it. That's what I could do for my friend's memory.
Sure.
It didn't involve anybody else in any kind of machinations or,
sure,
you know, jockeying for position. This was away from everybody, basically. And it was me, you know, it's the thing I could do for Gus and, you know, let the good times roll because it's New Orleans.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great place to be grieving.
Right. But so then I go through my thing and then I have to start seeing, like, you know, a psychiatric nurse. Is that what they call it? I guess I was seeing somebody to help with some of my issues, you know, mentally, help me sort through it because it was a lot that I had taken on.
Sure.
With my issues. And she said, you know, during all this grief, you're carrying so much grief, you kind of have to let your deceased friends kind of sit for a bit. And you have to take all the photos of them and put them away for a little bit just so you can get through your thing. And I said, you don't understand. Like, I just had a box delivered from New Orleans that has 3,000 metal images of my friend on it.
Yeah.
I can't just put away the pictures of my friend.
Of course not.
You know, I literally, to this day, I just ran out of the memorial stickers I made for the wake. But to this day, I still, with every mail order at Stand Up Records website, I throw in one of those doubloons.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily say what the story is, but I make sure that everyone who gets an order from me gets a picture of Gus.
Yeah, no,
metal that they have to cope with for the rest of their lives, or until they dispose of it, you know.
Right. Well, that's, you know, the idea of keeping alive the memories of the people that are so important to me is why I do this podcast. Part of it is just for free therapy. Part of it is I'm curious about how other people deal with it, but a lot of it is that I want to know more stories about Gus. I want to maybe find out, like, you know, what other people's, I like talking about these people because I don't really get an opportunity to talk about my dead friends in a way that is, you know, not, it's not the most approachable topic in everyday life. So yeah, it is. It's like, shit, I think they were funny. It's the same reason I'm going to, you know, I watch Gus's stand up on YouTube every now and then just to be like, oh yeah, those are funny jokes. I'm glad that I can hear them again.
Yeah, you know, and I can't do a lot for Gus because we weren't to the point of having recorded an album yet.
Right. We
were trying to get it kind of organized and put together and build enough time. And he wanted to record in Mexico. And we'd done that. We'd done some recording in Mexico during the festivals. But, you know, international travel takes a bit of logistics, a bit of making sure you have an audience. And I wanted to make sure the material was, like, as refined as possible, and we just had not hit that point. And I feel a bit of guilt about that. And my last conversation with Bill Young, I was cajoling him about needing to write more because he was so funny, and I just wanted his stuff to be organized better and thought out more and put into not so hodgepodge of a path of an organization as a 45-minute set. And when he died, all I could think of was my last conversation was me basically giving him a hard time, even though it was friendly. And I didn't do it because I wanted to be on bad terms with him. I did it because I loved him. And I wanted stuff to stand up to the level of everything else I work on.
I think clearly your intentions were in the right place. And he was a great comic. So if you're encouraging him, like, hey, make it tighter, let's record this. I don't think that's a guilt that you should necessarily hold on to. But
I'm able to relieve that guilt because your timing in interviewing me is fortuitous.
Okay. And I
say that because this is easier to do for Bill than it is for Gus, because there's a slight emotional detachment compared to what I had with Gus, but also because I have more resources. With Bill, I recorded him at the 499 show. We did a 499 show CD that I never released digitally. He did a 20-minute set there. I recorded this nerdy compilation called Nerd Alert at the Monday Night Comedy Show at the Beat Coffee House back then.
Yeah. And
Bill was on there. So I have like a 7-minute piece of that. I've recorded Bill in Mexico. I recorded him doing a couple of sets.
Sure.
And then I got a little bit of tape of him from Grumpy's Death Jam 10th anniversary. And I have a little piece of tape from Nick Piontek's The Greatest Comedy Show Ever over at Spring Street in Club Underground.
Sure. So you have stuff to pull from.
Yeah. So I went through every single bit of that tape and I charted out every joke told and how well it went over. And as I charted everyone out and I saw what was where, I could pick out which takes were the best. And then I took those notes and made another note that was like, if I were to organize these as an album, how would I do it? And what order would it go in? And where would the cuts need to be to go from one show to another show? And is that actually going to be able to be done without it being too jarring in sound quality?
Right.
The answer to that one is not always, but I have assembled a full album.
A Bill Young album.
A Bill Young. And it's missing a bunch of stuff. I wish it wasn't. There's stuff on YouTube that we just don't have good audio on. And there's jokes that are just gone.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest tragedies of comedians. Did you release this? Or is it available?
Hang on. So right. If I'm going to tell the story, I got to tell the story, right?
All right. I'll back my beats.
Yeah. Sorry about that. So I took all that stuff and then I ran it by his ex-wife and her kid, Bill's stepkid, to make sure that they were okay with anything that was said because they're in some of the material and they gave approval. So then I ran it by Andrew Brynaldson to see what he thought. And he just couldn't believe it. And he put me in touch with Bill's siblings, which I needed to talk to his direct family because if I'm going to do this, I need permission to do it. And I talked to them about it. They gave permission. I contacted Doug Kahlberg, who had drawn the memorial flyer for Gus or for Bill that said, eat the cake on it. It said, eat the effing cake on it. I'm censoring it for your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
So I had him change it to eat the cake and change it to a square format. And, you know, we talked about the dead space and the format change and he filled it up with a time machine and, you know, I got all that stuff assembled. I ran it by his family after they signed off on letting me do it, and they have approved it. And because Bill was a tremendous nerd, we are going to release it on what you call Mario Day, March 10th, when you run MAR10 Mario.
Nice.
So on March 10th of this year, Bill Young's posthumous album is coming out.
That's fantastic.
It's going to be a weird album because sometimes to include a line, I had to let the audio quality slip a little bit.
I'm sure that was probably hard for you as a sound engineer who's put out so many albums to be working through like maybe less than ideal. It's the exact
thing I hate about archival albums.
Right.
But mine sound better than the archival albums that I'm comparing it to. And, you know, some of the jokes he tells on this outdoor stage in Mexico that the Grateful Dead had built and used to perform on. And the show, I can picture it in my head because I was there. The show was happening about dusk as the sun started to set. And because it's outdoors and it's tropical, there's all these birds that are just cawing out while he's doing his set. And you hear like tropical birds while he's performing. And it's kind of crazy, but yet, you know, he was a regional comic, but I wanted to show that his reach was also bigger and that he'd been other places.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that he could have gone on to bigger and better and more things had he been able to stay with us.
Yeah. He was a pretty young dude too. I think he was 32 or something.
Yeah, he was in his 30s.
Which really surprised me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, he's, you know, some people look old when they're not.
Right. Well, that's Grandpa fantastic. Yeah. Well, I appreciate that you took the time and effort to put that together. I'm looking forward to that.
It's solid. Unfortunately, you know, it's going to be a mixed bag for people. I think a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, I didn't know the guy, so this doesn't make sense, because it's easy to do that because there's so many living comics putting out albums. But I think that Bill's memory is worth carrying forward and people should remember him.
Yeah.
So I did that, and I'm working on a little memorial project for myself related to Bill that I'm not fully ready to disclose just yet. It's not really for public. It's for me. But I'll tell you about that off air too. But
well, you know, I appreciate you doing that. It's good to keep the memories of good people alive. And he was very funny too. So,
well, Bill and Gus in particular, I was very close with them as far as like personal friends and also in the business, you know?
Yeah.
So I want to be able to pay my respects and say my goodbyes. And if I can earn some royalty money for their families,
yeah,
then that's a bit of a blessing that they're not forgotten. And that's really what the goal is. I have not gone through a review of what I have for Gus just yet, because, you know, that's still pretty much a smoldering crater for me 8 years on. I was in Ireland recording Glenn Wool in October, and but the night before the recording, I needed to eat. I was jet lagged. Two nights before the recording, I was jet lagged. And I woke up and the only thing that was open was a McDonald's up the hill, which was ironic, you know, but I went and I grabbed whatever garbage I ate there just so I could stuff something in my stomach. And I started walking back down the hill to my hotel, and the street that everything was on is this street that has like pubs and bars and stuff. And you hear music coming out, and one of the bars, some guy was just playing Wish You Were Here by Pink Floyd. And I just stopped and I leaned against the outside wall of the bar and I just ugly cried.
Mm.
I just ugly cried. And it took me a few, you know, people are looking at me as they walk by, and it just wasn't
the American eating McDonald's and crying.
I wasn't eating at that point. I was just the guy standing outside, bent over oddly and crying.
Yeah. You don't really get to pick when those moments are, evoked, and especially when musical cues can set things off for me.
Yeah, Heroes and Wish You Were Here for Gus are just, and there's a couple of local band songs too by like Chuglin and stuff that those were really the moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Illegal Smile by John Prine, and you know, those songs remind me of my times with Gus, and just sort of stopped me dead in my tracks. And when I remember Gus, Gus is kind of a symbol for all of them. You know, they all get grouped on. If I say Gus, I really mean Gus and Kate and Bill and Mike DiStefano, and, you know, to a lesser extent, Mitch and Sean Rouse. And it's all of that. When I say Gus, sure. Gus is just a symbol, and Dave from the Cancer Center, he's just the symbol of all of it. Cause it's way easier to group it as under three letters, you know. And
sure.
And I went down the hill from there to my hotel, and I didn't go into the hotel. I went straight into the lobby bar, and they said, what can we do? I said, double Jameson and a Guinness, please. Because I'm in Ireland.
Sure.
And Gus Lynch, his family is from Ireland. And the bartender put the drinks down in front of me, and I grabbed the Jameson and I looked at the bartender. It was only me and the bartender in the bar. I said, I'd like to have a traditional Irish toast. And he poured himself a small shot of Jameson, and he held up his glass, and I said, fuck the British. And we hit the glasses on the bar and drank them. And yes. I did that because that's how, what Gus.
That's Gus's. Yeah.
And I just sat there and I thought about my dear departed friends.
Sure.
And I spent, you know, jet lag's a hell of a thing, especially when you go east. So every night was a shot of Jameson and a Guinness to try and get to sleep at a normal time. And that's the extent of my partying ability at this point.
Well, it's good to dial it back sometimes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I dialed it back, you know, when Gus died, and then when I died, it was like the dial's just been broken off.
Yeah, I'd imagine there's some wake-up calls in those.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't ever terribly excessive. You know, I kept my stuff kind of straight because I had a business to run and all that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I never was a wild, wild guy, but I had my fun. And I think everyone should have some fun in their lives because you only get this life.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of how that all dovetails together for me. It just hits when it hits. My dad hits usually, you know, it's always there, but it usually hits me from November through April pretty hard every year.
Okay.
So, you know, the fall season is always the roughest time for me because it's when we lost Bill, it's when we lost Gus, it's when we lost my dad. It's
sure. You know,
a lot of loss. And then before my dad got sick in November, died in April. Mike DiStefano died in like March or end of February. You know, April Fools for Hedberg.
All these dates that are just permanently wired into your brain now with associations.
Well, at least the seasons are. I try not to fixate on the dates too much. With Gus and my dad are the ones that really lodge in.
Sure.
Because those two were the most important to me, I guess. I don't know why, but they are.
Well.
And, you know, that's where it is. And again, you know, you struggle with that abyss, but, you know, I also carry on so that I can carry them forward.
It's good philosophy. It's a good way to approach things.
Yeah. And I don't want to play this game like everything I do is for them. I don't stay in touch with all the other survivors or anything like that. This is much like they weren't part of my business before my business, you know, not Gus and everyone else was not part of my business or my life before that. Those people were.
Yeah.
I carry them with me. And if other people appreciate that or don't appreciate that, that's on them. I don't have time for that baggage. I only have time for my deal.
Yeah. We life's short enough. Don't need to waste time.
Yeah. And I mean, now that I have, you know, you're asking me if this hospital thing straightened out my priorities. Yeah. Yeah. I focus a lot more on stuff I care about, stuff that I enjoy. A lot of dead weight has been removed from my life. And I don't mean that. I carry my friends still. So that's not the dead weight I'm talking about.
It's
people that are just there to
toxicness.
Yeah, the toxicness, the inter-scene politics, the politically correct and incorrect crap. You know, I don't need anyone else's BS staining what it is that I do. I'm enough of a stain.
Okay.
I'll carry my own crap.
That's fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Dan, I appreciate your time. And thanks for, you know, telling me all this stuff.
Well, thanks for having me. I hope it was enlightening.
Yeah, I feel like I learned about myself, about you, a little bit about death.
Yeah, we all. It's going to touch everybody at some point. So,
yeah,
you know, it's got to gird your loins and deal.
Right, but you know, it's comfort in the fact that it happens to everyone. It's, you know, just some of us get there sooner than others.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing you got to try and keep in mind is to make your time seem worth it, because you know there's not a question your time is going to come at some point. What have you done to make it worth it? I'm not saying you have to be a charitable person. I'm not saying you have to be a good person necessarily or a bad person. But I'm saying, what did you do to make your time here worth it?
Yeah,
and to me, that's really what I'm about now. So, you know, I've been focusing my creativity on some stuff that I've loved since I was a kid. I've not abandoned my business at all. You know, I keep that up and moving, and I have some really crazy stuff coming. And, you know, I just want to enjoy I don't know if it'll be right after I hang up with you or 60 years from now, but at some point my number is going to get punched.
Sure.
And when it was, I want to have at least, you know, done some stuff I care
about. Sure. Made an impact.
Yeah. Well, impact's neither here nor there. I just want to at least make sure I did some stuff I care about.
Sure. Well, I'm glad your health's in a better place and you sort of now, you know, are able to look at it with that vantage point.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy to have made it to this point.
Yeah, good. Well, where can people find you? Stand Up Records, obviously.
StandUpRecords.com is the main place. If you go to Twitter anymore, at Stand Up Records there, and also on Instagram at Stand Up Records. I'm probably on Instagram more than I am on Twitter. And then, of course, you know, Facebook, for as long as it keeps chugging along at whatever disappointing thing it's become lately.
Sure.
You know, Stand Up Records there as well.
Okay. And Bill Young coming out on Mario Day.
Yes, Bill Young coming out on Mario Day.
Thanks for doing that. That's really great of you.
I miss him so much. I just wish he was here to see that I did this. I really would rather see his face than.
Yeah.
But anyway, I have it in my head of what it's like when he smiles, and that's good enough. But you are welcome. I hope you dig it when you hear it. The name of it is Eat the Cake.
Right, because I remember that joke about him winning the cake at the cakewalk and the time travel or so. I can sort of picture what you were telling me about the description of the cover art.
Yeah, it's very much tied to that joke, and that joke is on there in full. That's one of the ones that jumps back and forth a little bit because I didn't want to leave lines out.
So it's from different recordings.
Yeah. Like if I read you the track, I have to keep the metadata for all the various ways you track sales nowadays. And one of the things they want is recording location. And some of these tracks have like 4 or 5 recording locations.
Sure. Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for putting in the work to do that.
No worries. And then, you know, once we get wrapped, let's hang out and shoot for the bull for another minute or two before you have to get to your life.
Cool. Well, let's wrap this up and then,
okay, that works.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, no worries. Talk soon, Micah.
So that was episode 14. I want to thank Dan Schlissel for sharing his story. I want to thank everybody who's listening and everybody who's been listening. Appreciate the support. Feel free to tell your friends about it. Write some type of review on the internet. I don't know. I made about 1,000 stickers for this podcast. So if you see me walking around New York, feel free to ask for one. And that's about it. New episodes coming soon. Be good to yourselves. Goodbye.